There we go.
Basically, you could start by telling me when you started here.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to stop and think about that. I started as a graduate student with Mura, and I'm pretty sure about the time. It was February 1965. I started as a graduate student for Keith Simon. I don't know if you remember. Know of Keith Simon?
I heard his name.
Okay. Well, he was in the physics department at the university at the time. And I knew of him mainly because he's the author of a well-known book on mechanics, sophomore/junior mechanics that you'd take if you were in a physics program. Well, anyway, I started working for him. I worked for him for a while, and then, I don't know how that happened that I got, I know what it was. This was towards the end of Mura already in 65. Mura as such. Because July 1 of 1967 is when Mura was completely dissolved and the Physical Sciences Laboratory was formed and officially took over the buildings and grounds out here at the laboratory. Of course, the Physical Sciences Laboratory still is over there. But that's all there was at that time, plus the land. And also included the facility, which is up by County Road B, with the accelerator underground and the other buildings that were there. Plus, that was all that was here. And the way the university did, my recollection, the way the university did it was because Mura was ending, the agreement was such that the staff of Mura at the time had three options. You could take a position that perhaps was offered with Fermilab at the time. I'm not even sure it was officially Fermilab at the time, but that was one option. And some people did that. They went to work down and for Fermilab at that time, really in its infancy. Another option would be you could have gone and taken a position with Argonne National Laboratory down in the Chicago area, that's outside, which already had a large accelerator facility, but as a national laboratory, there were a lot of other options. So some of the people I know from Mura that were in the source group, in other words, what you want to call them, any kind of electron source or or proton source group design studies, etc., went down, could have gone to Argonne National Laboratory, and some did. And the last option was just basically to stay with the Physical Sciences Laboratory and now become part of the university. The other people that see, that would have been a complete change, because if you were with Mura, then you could have gone into the other jobs at Fermilab or at Argonne and kind of still stayed federal employees. Whereas if you went with the Physical Sciences Lab, you became basically a state employee, state of Wisconsin. So my option, since I was still partially in school, I decided to stay. I didn't work for Keith Simon anymore. I worked for a while with the group, a couple of different groups, moved around. I worked in one of the projects had to do with the plasma physics department on campus. A group here at the Physical Sciences Laboratory, at PSL, were involved in designing what was then called an octopole, which is a large, one of the very early on containment devices for plasmas. Large-scale plasma devices. And at the time, Tantalus, I think, was probably, I don't know what stage of construction it was in. When I started, I knew nothing about Tantalus. and only got to learn a little bit more about it when MIRA actually dissolved into PSL, into the Physical Sciences Laboratory. And I started working a little bit on some small projects having to do with upgrading of Tantalus. Mm-hmm. One of the things that came in about it was the possibility of an early version of what we call the Wiggler for Tantalus, and that's what my thesis project was.
So what is the Wiggler?
Well, it's like a one pole undulator, single pole undulator. All it does is take the beam in Tantalus and in one of the small straight sections wiggle it one way so that you can get a real high field region and you can get some higher energy photons out of it. It's essentially the same as what's called, there are wigglers now, and it's a single pole undulator is what it is, but it doesn't wiggle the beam back and forth, it just bends it out and bends it back and corrects it.
How does that differ from the ones here? They have something like that, the undulators.
Right, but undulators are usually, by definition, the name undulator means you make a lot of excursions of the electron beam back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add their fluxes. You can either add their fluxes linearly by summing all the poles, or you can add them in quadrature if you actually get operating in a mode where it more of a free electron laser mode.
What do you mean by quad?
Well, if you have a whole bunch of poles, let's say there are n poles,
mm-hmm.
Okay, then what you're doing is you're adding the flux by n, because you're making wiggles back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so the flux out is proportional to n, but there are ways of operating it so that the flux out depends on n squared. And so then you're in a mode where you get a lot of radiation out of an undulator.
Okay.
That typically doesn't happen in the undulators in Aladdin, or it didn't certainly wouldn't have happened in the thing I was working on for Tantalus, because there was only one pole. At the same time, they were thinking about a couple of other improvements, and one was to change the injector. There had been a large, relatively large, but relatively low energy electron injector up at the site up there. And that was a special kind of accelerator called, it's abbreviatedly called an FFAG, but that stands for Fixed Field Alternating Gradient. And it was one of the models that was built up there during the times when MIRA was experimenting and developing accelerators. But it served as a good injector for Tantalus, something on the order of 40 MeV electrons, and you could inject that into Tantalus. And one of the projects was to eliminate that because it had come, that injector, because it had come to the end of its useful days, basically. That was the project that Mike Green, another guy over at, that still works actually, mm-hmm. for Aladdin. That was his research project, was to build a microtron injector for Tantalus. So a lot of things were happening to Tantalus at that time. They were getting a new injector, and along with the new injector was a new transport line, a new line to carry the electrons from the injector to Tantalus, and one single pole Wiggler project, and there was a new vacuum chamber going in into the ring. New vacuum chamber. Originally, the vacuum chamber was one which was not, the whole original Tantalus project was not originally aimed at synchrotron radiation. It was originally aimed as a how shall I say it? The idea was to, my understanding of it originally, was to have a proof of principle electron storage ring for electron-positron colliders. Something that you could study how electrons and positrons could mm-hmm. collide in something which is relatively small, only a 300 MeV machine. anyway, it became clear that the positron part of that wasn't going to happen. And at that early on, and probably, again, I would be guessing about the time, it would probably have to be about the same time that Mira turned into PSL, it became clear that if Tantalus was going to survive as a facility for experimentation, it was most likely going to be on the route of synchrotron radiation. And since the chamber was never built initially for synchrotron radiation users, decided to put a new chamber in during this upgrade time.
What year was that when all these upgrades?
Well, that's a good question. I'd have to guess it would have to be around 68, 69, okay. 70, someplace in there.
All right.
Maybe 67.
Good time frame. Okay.
And all of that happened, and microtron worked fine, the vacuum chamber worked fine, the single pole wiggler did not work well at all, and it had some problems with life. Well, it had a major problem with lifetime. The electron beam didn't want to live. We got enough data to show that it did what it was supposed to, but you could never use it from the point of view of lifetime. I mean, the beam would not stay stored in there. So it didn't go away instantly, but it went away pretty fast. So it was left in the ring, but basically never used. But the rest of the time, the Tantalus was used, quite a bit. It had a big experimental program for many years.
How many people were working at the time at Tantalus?
Are you talking about users, or are you talking about the staff?
Just the staff on hand, in general.
Well, don't forget that for a while, there was no facility here. So we were basically staffed over, and even for a long time, we were staffed at PSL. I'm guessing 20, 25.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just a guess.
Just to get a scope of
yeah.
how things have grown from where we came from.
Yeah, they probably haven't grown all that much, but yeah, and that number might be kind of on the high side.
And what about the users?
Again, there was a user community which kept continually growing and changing over. Now, I don't know. Initially, the funding for Tantalus was I'm pretty sure it was the Department of Defense. And I don't know at what point it became funded by the National Science Foundation. There was some point at which it actually became the Synchrotron Radiation Center, even though it was based and housed in PSL and the site. In other words, it had a sort of, and Esther probably knows this more than anybody, it had had become an entity of itself, even though it was under a different roof.
Mm-hmm.
And then the funding started to come from the National Science Foundation.
Okay, so maybe you could tell me a little bit more about
5:30.
Yeah, the clock's been there for quite a while now. Time's standing still.
Needs a new battery, Lord, it needs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you were a graduate student, you said, at the time?
Yeah, and finished up my degree, and I stayed on in the accelerator group.
Okay.
With Tantalus. One of the first things that we got involved with was a project. This was PSL and the accelerator group, which soon would become the Synchrotron Radiation Center, combined. We got involved with a project of upgrading the synchrotron at the National Bureau of, what was then the National Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. It actually is now called the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, NIST. But at that time, it was the National Bureau of Standards. They had a very old electron synchrotron, and it was an AC machine, so it actually cycled at 60 hertz, and it had air-cooled coils. It was archaic. And the people out there, one particular Bob Madden, who was, I don't know what position he had at that time, but thought that he and Ed Rowe evidently knew each other quite well, and decided that they would inquire whether or not our group, our accelerator group here, would be willing to take on a project of turning their synchrotron into an electron storage ring, which we did. And that probably happened, we did the designing and we did a bunch of construction. We had a whole bunch of parts and everything delivered. We built them a small microtron. We tested the microtron here. We transported that out to Washington, D.C. And then back and forth, three or four of us at a time, two sometimes, would go out for a week at a time to get it operational. And I think that was probably in the early 70s, between 72 and 75, someplace in there. That would be my guess. Again, that's a guess.
Yeah, it's fine. Rough estimates are all right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were working with the NIST and then...
NIST, N-I-S-T.
Oh, N-I-S-T.
Yeah. National Institute of Standards and Technology.
So can you continue on of...
Okay, then that got done, and then after that, we just was a time when other groups were looking to extend the synchrotron radiation sources, and the accelerator group that was only had tantalus at the time, and that is SRC, looked at several designs for kind of next generation synchrotron radiation sources. We actually designed several things that were upgrades of tantalus. They looked a lot like the tantalus machine, but they were just bigger and higher energy.
Yeah.
Okay. And that really didn't go anywhere. And then we spent some time on design of Aladdin, actually. And then that was funded. Now, I don't know when that got off the ground funding-wise. Somehow 79 sticks in my mind. It may have been 78 or 77. Or the design may have been completed in that area and funding was starting out or something. And, of course, that meant that there was to be a new building, a new facility, a new site, and proceed along with that. But Tantalus was still running.
Mm-hmm.
And there was still a large experimental program, and we started getting experiments off of Tantalus as we, actually before we were really done with Aladdin. We had some problems early on with Aladdin having to do with understanding a thing called ion trapping. The physics of it is that if you have an electron beam in a chamber, it has a large negative potential well. And the beam itself will ionize some of the gas molecules. You never get the gas completely out, even mm-hmm. though it's a really good vacuum. Some of them get ionized. And typically you scrape off electrons, so they're positively charged. Okay, well, you've got a big negative potential well. So beyond a certain point, if the electron charge density is too high, what you've done is you've built in, where the electrons are, a large target. And that is all of these ions which are positively mm-hmm. charged. And it's self-defeating. Then the electrons just collide with all the ions and the lifetime of the beam, its ability to stay in the ring for any length of time, goes all to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took us a while to solve that problem. But beam lines were moving over already from Tantalus to move on to Aladdin, even at the time we were trying to figure that out. Ultimately, all it did was require something called clearing electrodes to be put into Aladdin. And these are negatively charged wires along the side of the vacuum chamber, which attract the positive ions mm-hmm. and keep them out of the way of the beam. And then the electrons can be happy. But, and then at that point, I don't know, probably early 80s, 83, 84, the machine, Aladdin started to really come online. And that was a time when the rest of Tantalus got to be shut down, except maybe for a few experiments, but they eventually all moved over here. Now, you'd have to look at the date that, well, the facility up there was maintained for quite a while, even though there were no users. And I don't know exactly when the Smithsonian came and took all their stuff. Mm-hmm. But that should be easy to find out.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, if you want to think about it, that's really the end of Tantalus. So when they, the Smithsonian took half of the machine, the other half of Tantalus was junked. And we had, but before that happened, they had a lot of pictures, took a lot of videotape of the disassembly of the machine, a lot of interviews, and that's pretty much all there was of Tantalus.
In terms of differences between Tantalus and Aladdin, some of the big differences between the particles?
Ooh, well, energy is one. Mm-hmm. Tantalus had a peak energy of around 300 MeV electrons. Whereas Aladdin can go up to 1,000 MeV. And that makes a big difference, tremendous difference. Now the magnets themselves probably are a little bit stronger on Aladdin, so that, I'd have to look, it seems to me that, well, you'd have to do the calculation. I know that on Aladdin, the so-called critical wavelength at 1 GeV is roughly around 1 kilovolt photons. And I don't remember what it was on Tantalus, but it was way down. It was, you were lucky if you could get reasonable fluxes in the real, real soft X-rays. Mm-hmm. Maybe above the, this is my remembering. The way I remember it is, green is typically something on the order of 3 electron volts. So if you could get up to 100 electron volts on Tantalus, you were doing well. Whereas at 1 GeV on Aladdin, the critical wavelength is, critical energy is about a kilo electron volt, 1,000 electron volts, and that means that there's even flux reasonably higher than that for experiments. So that's the real big thing is, number one is photon energy. The second one is source size. In other words, the fact that there was nothing in Tantalus that was ever done to design a machine for a small source, small cross-section to the electron beam, because it was never originally intended for synchrotron radiation. But there was some effort done on Aladdin to have a small vertical beam size, and the lattice was designed to try to do that. And then, again, Tantalus was never designed with any kind of space in it for putting insertions, whereas Aladdin had, by design, 4 long straight sections. Originally, one of them was used for the RF cavity, but then later on, when people learned how to do things better, we were able to make a different RF cavity and end up with 4 long straight sections. Now they even know how to design smaller wigglers to put into the short straight sections. So that would never be possible on Tantalus. Just not enough space. Again, it was never designed for it. And Tantalus had 8 magnets, so you maybe could get 2 beam lines on each magnet, and then there was 2 beam lines which were completely not usable because there was a big RF cavity. So I don't know, what does that amount to? 2 times 8 is 16. You maybe had 12 to 14 beam lines. Nominally, you could have 3 on every bending magnet on Aladdin. Mm-hmm. So that's 36. Plus, you're not occulting any of them. And so you're already, you're just the experimental program can be so much bigger.
Okay, maybe go back to where we were before.
Okay.
Just more of your story of where you were. So we left off at when Aladdin had just kind of taken over and Tantalus had, the Smithsonian came for the, for Tantalus. So maybe a little bit of your role or your job here.
Oh, well, I don't know. Let's see, what can I say? I've always been an accelerator of science. And when I started out, I was just in the group working on various problems. I got involved one of the things I was had pretty heavily involved with was the upgrade for the National Bureau of Standards machine. I guess I didn't finish quite that story because they came back in probably the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. They wanted another upgrade. They wanted to go to the possibility of going to slightly higher energy with that machine. Originally, when PSL did the upgrade, I kept the whole magnet that was there. And now they said, well, what would happen if we actually built a whole new magnet? And one of the things that they were after was a very precisely measured magnetic field. You might say, well, why do they need that in particular? What they wanted to do is the following. At the National Bureau of Standards, NIST, I guess it is now, it turns out that if you know the electron energy exactly, let's see if I got this right now. If you know the electron energy that's circulated in a storage ring, and if you know the magnetic field and you know the radius of curvature, those two geometric kinds of things exactly, you can analytically calculate the photon spectrum that comes out. Okay. And this was done many years ago. So, if you know the photon spectrum that comes out, you can have an absolute calibration on detectors rather than a relative calibration. You can tell somebody that has a detector, well, we've got so many photons per square millimeter per second, and what their bandwidth is, at what energy and at what bandwidth. And so that makes absolute calibration a thing that the Bureau of Standards, of course, would like to be able to do. But they didn't have that kind of magnet in the machine. So they said, well, let's ask PSL/SRC to design and build them a new magnet, which would actually replace the whole magnet that was there and give them that calibration. And that was done. SRC kind of did the accelerator part and PSL did the construction, and that worked out pretty well too. And I was heavily involved in that. Some of the SRC people were too. Bob Bosch and I'm trying to think who else. Well, some of the control system people, but yeah, that. And I don't know exactly when that happened. Somehow late 80s, early 90s rings a bell, but we have to look it up.
Did that work contribute to the stuff done on the SRC when that was being built?
In a sense, not really, but what you end up with is a situation where if you're a scientist like that, accelerator science, any machine that you work on, you learn something that you can apply later on into your home facility, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And so to answer, and from that point of view, it was always helpful, and it pays the bills too. Because what happened is the staff at SRC that were working on that project, as well as PSL, were able to bill out their services to the National Bureau of Standards in their grant. And so that helped, it helped for a while along those lines. I mean, it was financially advantageous for SRC to do that. That was true the first time also for the first upgrade to that machine. It was the same kind of deal. They were willing to pay, and so we offered up our services.
What about the construction of Aladdin? Were you involved in that?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how much of Aladdin you want to get into. Are you trying to do this whole history, or are you trying to stick most of the Tantalus?
I'm trying to just get a broad sense of it all.
Okay.
I figured if you were willing, we could do follow-up interview as well.
Oh, sure.
Once I sift through all this and find some.
Well, to answer your question, I was heavily involved in, well, first of all, I was heavily involved in the design. And then we were heavily involved, I was heavily involved with the construction. That means design and ordering of factory parts and assembly magnets. And if you walk into the Aladdin building, it used to be, there was a picture on the wall which shows pretty much Aladdin by itself,
yeah,
ignored.
Yeah.
And if you look carefully, there are two, three people in that picture. I'm one of them. So I was involved with helping the alignment of all the components, mm-hmm. and then was heavily involved in getting the machine operational. And then for a long time, I had the job of, I was in charge of the accelerator group. And then when, let's see, when did that happen? For a while after Ed Rowe passed away, I was kind of in charge of the accelerator division temporarily until Joe came online.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've been involved until I retired. Now, I retired in 2001, August of 2001. Geez, that's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Aladdin was a fun project, but you know, I don't know how many accelerators the average accelerator scientist has in their career, professional career. Some people, you know, just stay on kind of forever and just keep doing that sort of thing. But after doing the work, the upgrading work on Tantalus, two upgrades for the National Bureau of Standards, and this and Aladdin, which turned out to be a really long continuing project because they're still putting undulators in Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it took a long time to get it going because of the problems they had initially. There was one time where the National Science, we couldn't get enough current in Aladdin, so the National Science Foundation actually stopped funding. And the university picked up the funding for a short term until we got our act together and figured out what was going wrong. And then the National Science Foundation retracted itself and started funding it again. So there was a time where it was pretty touch and go.
Those problems you mentioned, I think they had said there was a problem with the ground shifting. Is that it couldn't be level?
No, I'm talking about the ion trapping.
Okay. Oh, that. Okay.
Yeah. What they're talking about with respect to the ground shifting has to do more with the fact that the electron beam itself in the machine, once it's there, has a fair amount of latitude in its position. Okay, you can move it several millimeters, and it'll be perfect head happy. But if you have a long optical beam line with a monochromator on the end, that's really a fine instrument, and it's lined up very carefully on the source image. Now, if that electron beam moves by a millimeter, you lose all your intensity at your experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Now you say, well, what can make the beam move a millimeter? Well, a lot of things. But one that can do it is if the ground moves a little bit. And early on we found that some of that is the result just of the floor shifting. And things were done then to take care of that by taking the magnets off of standing on the floor and instead putting them on special mounts that go all the way down to the bedrock. There's a lot of things that were done. So I guess, I'm not sure, but right now everything is pretty just. Mm-hmm. It has been probably for the last 10 years. But every once in a while, it's more likely now that you'll have a some other kind of hardware problem which will cause difficulties. What do I mean by that? One of the things that happens is that you can never design the magnets perfectly, so there's little correctors. And one of the correctors may not be functioning right, and so the beam would be perfectly happy to be off a little bit in some place, but again, the user's beam line will be suffering. Mm-hmm. So you have to make sure that all around the ring the beam is in the right spot. And there are a lot of things that, besides the ground, there are a lot of things that can cause difficulties along those lines. Change the RF frequency a little bit, that does it. Or early on we were having some problems with, what was happening is that we had, the way the magnets work is they're coils, they're water-cooled coils on the big bending magnets that cause the beam to go around the corner. And we had grounded one part of those, I'm trying to think what the deal is. What was happening was that because there was a voltaic voltage drop distribution along some of the hoses between the water source and the coil. Now these are water-cooled coils, mm-hmm. So what it is it's a hollow tube that conducts electricity and you put water down the middle of it. Well, you have to be able to separate the voltage from the water, and you do that with a rubber tube. So it acts as plenty insulation. The only problem is, depending on how the voltage goes to ground, you can have some of the copper from the tube deposited on the inside of that hose. And that deposit builds up and you get more conductivity through that hose than you really want. And so what happens is the magnet is not functioning quite exactly the way it should. Some of them are different and the beam may move around. Hmm. And so you have to develop a program which eliminates that problem. Well, that's the kind of thing that was done over the years. Is you find some things that are not really the best for the operation of the machine and you correct them. Has to be done. Mm-hmm. Problems with magnets, problems with the RF system. The original radio frequency system was in a long straight section. It was moved into a short straight section. And it opens up some space for another undulator. And periodically, sections of vacuum chamber have to be replaced because they develop leaks. And, it's just a list of ongoing maintenance as well as improvements.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely what we were looking into, is getting a lot of the specifics of the particle accelerators. So this is just really good. Maybe we can go back to Tantalus if there's any other big moments that you experienced or had, or anything you'd like to add to about your time at Tantalus.
Well, I don't know. Let's see. I'm trying to think.
If you'd like, we could take a break here.
No, that's not necessary. I don't think of it. I could think of, I guess it would be better off if I thought about it for a while.
Yeah.
Or maybe jot down some notes. And then
that would be great. If we
get together and bring those up. That's a long time ago now. One of the things clearly was the people that we worked with. They were always really good, sharp scientists, but also nice people. And I remember in particular that later on in the user life of Tantalus, because of the way synchrotron radiation research is done, you didn't always have the facility, you didn't always need to run the electron beam, because the users would be doing some other preparation of experiments or data analysis on weekends. In particular on Tantalus, at around 4:30 on Friday, the beam was done for the weekend. And so it was not unusual to have kind of a, what you call, a little bit of a social hour right at 4:30. And the users and the staff and get together and maybe have a beer and talk about what happened that week or talk about why the Badgers aren't doing well or something like that. That was always, those were always fun times. And get the accelerated group would get to interact a little bit more with the users too and find out what their problems were. There again, I think it'd be better if I just thought about it.
When you had said that Tantalus originally wasn't designed for synchrotron works and things like this, more of storage, electron storage, and then it said it found its use in synchrotron.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about that transition? I had seen a picture of that they carved a window hole into it and they saw the light coming out of it.
Oh, that could be. To start out with, if you had a machine that was just going to do electron-positron experiments, there would be no need at all for any kind of glass port. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there are a couple of things that are important. Number one, at least as far as Tantalus goes, you have to look at, and this is, you can get an idea, as soon as you know the current and the energy, you can get an estimate of how much power is delivered from the synchrotron radiation. And you quickly understand that you have to be careful about what size beam you have and at what energy, otherwise you just puncture the windows. Mm-hmm. And you let the whole ring up there, which is not good. So at some point they decided that they needed to have a couple of regular valves on some of these vacuum chamber ports that come out. I don't know if there were any ports at all in the original vacuum chamber design. And they probably took a couple of sections and made ports. Now this is before the time that I got involved with Tantalus. Okay. And because I was working at PSL, but I was working on different projects. Mm-hmm. And didn't have anything to do with the electron storage ring. I think a couple of places were put in there. It wasn't that synchrotron radiation was pretty well understood at that point. In other words, early accelerators that were electron machines demonstrated synchrotron radiation. In other words, there were people that had ports in smaller machines, and you could see the light. It'd light up a room, you know, there were a couple of ports, and mm-hmm. see the light coming out. So you knew that it was there. It's just that nobody ever thought to make use of it in some sort of scientific way, make use of the light for certain kinds of experiments. And I do not know when they originally got installed into Tantalus. I do know that, as I pointed out earlier, there was a program afoot to replace that whole vacuum chamber, provide more ports, and to make beam lines more available. That was a program that I was involved with early on. Actually, Cliff Olson was involved with that too, I remember. We had the vacuum chamber over at PSL building. We assembled the vacuum chamber ahead of time and baked it out and checked it out, make sure it would function properly. Then disassembled it at the PS, haul it up to the site and put it into the ring.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I have to think about it.
All right, that's fine. Well, we can stop today.
That was...